This is Radio Times. Good to have you with us. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Psychosomatic illness has been defined as physical symptoms which occur for psychological reasons. The symptoms can be severe and life-altering, including blindness, excruciating abdominal pain, seizures, and paralysis. Patients can spend weeks, months, and years in and out of hospitals in a desperate search for a cure, flummoxing doctors who can't find the cause, and frustrating other physicians who determine that it is all in the patient's head. Our guest today says, yes, psychosomatic illness originates in the psyche, but the suffering is genuine and common. Experts say about 20% of patients worldwide are affected, and psychosomatic illness is expensive, costing health systems billions. Joining us this hour to share her expertise and insight is Suzanne O'Sullivan, a consultant in neurophysiology and neurology at the National Hospital for Neurology and Neurosurgery in London, and author of Is It All in Your Head? True Stories of Imaginary Illnesses. Suzanne O'Sullivan joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you.
And let me take just a moment to give the number out so we can bring our listeners into the conversation. It's 888-477-9499. You can send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org or a tweet at @WHYYRadioTimes. So, Suzanne, let's begin by exploring the mind-body connection. You write in your book, we are familiar with the shake in our hand as we pick up the pen to sign the marriage register, or the bead of sweat on our brow as we stand up to give the presentation we don't want to give. These are the body's physiological responses to stress. Could you tell us a bit more about this?
I think that our bodies are constantly reacting to emotions that we're experiencing and also reacting to the attention that we pay to our bodies. And it is incredibly easy to induce symptoms in ourselves with very little trigger at all. You know, if you knew that you'd been sitting on a bus beside somebody who had lice, then you would immediately start feeling skin itch or the symptoms, even if you didn't actually catch the problem. So I think that, you know, for us to develop symptoms that feel very real to us takes very little. And we accept that. We experience it and we brush it off. But I think what people really are unaware of is that when a person is exposed to much more extreme trigger, much more extreme physical symptoms can occur. So we're familiar with the racing hearts and the shaking hands and skin itches, but people seem to be less familiar with symptoms like severe pain or paralysis or seizures or blindness. But in fact, those things are not uncommon.
You profile a number of patients in your book, and we're very careful to protect their identities. Before we get to some of these stories, what struck you about these patients?
Really, you know, it was a journey for me to deal with people who had these sort of conditions, because I went through the same misunderstandings with people who have psychosomatic disabilities that everyone has. So when you see someone for the first time who's paralyzed, but there is no disease to explain it and it's anatomically impossible, it's often so incongruous that one is tempted to believe that the person is putting it on or faking it in some way. What really I have learned through working with my patients for over 10 years is how absolutely genuine the suffering is, and also how terribly disabling. And unfortunately, when someone's given a diagnosis of a psychosomatic condition, most people consider that a dismissal or a downgrading of the disability. But the truth is that the disability that is caused by psychological behavioral factors is every bit as disabling as any sort of other problem. And if we don't offer these people help, then it will they will remain disabled.
The point to remember is they don't realize that this originates in the mind. They think it's something else.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's super important, because most people, when you discuss things like a psychosomatic paralysis, for example, you know, there is a general misunderstanding that the person has some sort of insight or there is some volition, that they have some choice over this matter, and that if they just wish to do so, they could get up and walk again. That very much is not the case. I usually say to my patients, you know, if you were in a job interview or if I was nervous about something and you saw my hands shaking, you wouldn't even consider the possibility that my hands were shaking on purpose or that this was deliberate or that I could control it. And that is very much the same for these other sorts of disabilities. They're unconsciously generated and outside the patient's control.
So let's talk about some of the stories. The first you recount goes back to when you were training in neurology and you met a patient named Brenda, who you name Brenda. Mm. She'd come to the emergency room. She had been suffering seizures. She ended up in a medically induced coma. Could you quickly sketch the rest of her story for us?
Yes, I mean, she was someone I saw when I hadn't seen a lot of seizures. And for people who have seen seizures, they're terrifying things. And for doctors and medical staff, you know, we're desperate to intervene because the person looks very distressed. So there was a suspicion when Brenda was having a very prolonged seizure that it may be what we now call a dissociative, what used to be called a hysterical seizure, so a seizure for psychological reasons. But people's sort of need to intervene meant that she was treated for epilepsy on the sort of just-in-case sort of parameter, because we fear that if we don't treat someone when we see them seizing that they'll come to harm. The consequence was, although there was a heavy suspicion that her seizure had a psychological cause, she ended up in intensive care on a ventilator and taking a lot of quite dangerous medications. And it only became clear after she had been seen by a consultant, I was a junior doctor at the time, that there was unequivocal evidence that this was a hysterical or dissociative seizure. And really, it was a very steep learning curve for me because it taught me, not at the time, but many years later, that we tend to leave this psychosomatic diagnosis as a sort of diagnosis of exclusion or something that's unimportant. We need to search for diseases and we need to treat diseases. And even if we suspect something psychosomatic, we neither discuss it nor address it until we've spent a huge amount of time ruling out disease. But harm could potentially be done by acting in that way, by neglecting the psychosomatic diagnosis in this particular lady. She was over-medicated and she was in a dangerous situation in the intensive care unit. But similarly, if you take somebody with paralysis and you investigate them for a year for disease and ignore psychosomatic conditions, then you're denying that person the treatment that could help them at a very early stage.
Let's talk about some of the tools that you use to diagnose. You use the MRI when trying to diagnose seizure or even paralysis. What happens if a person has a dissociative seizure as compared to one that is caused by epilepsy? What do you see on the MRI?
Well, not on an MRI scan, but on the neurological system is very amenable to measurement, both through the physical examination and also through electrical tests that test the integrity of the nervous system. So a great concern for patients is that if they're told they have a psychosomatic paralysis or a dissociative seizure, that actually it's just a missed diagnosis, a disease that we haven't yet discovered. But in fact, our anatomical, kind of the way our nervous systems are organized is such that functional or psychogenic paralysis and seizures do not look anything like the sort of paralysis and seizures people get with disease. Mm-hmm. So they tend to not obey anatomical rules. And there is a very big disparity between objective things like reflexes and subjective things like the strength the patient experiences or their consciousness. But also then when you do electrical studies during the symptoms to test the integrity of the nervous system, those electrical studies are normal, which really means that the seizure could not be due to epilepsy or the paralysis could not be due to a neurological disease.
So sometimes the diagnosis is clear on your end. But quite often, if I'm getting this correct from your book, when you go to the patient and you tell the patient the good news is there's nothing physically wrong, they don't necessarily take it as good news. As a matter of fact, there quite often is a sense of shame involved.
Absolutely. It's a very difficult diagnosis for people to take on board. In the first instance, it's often quite unexpected because it's an entirely unconscious process. So they've come to me as a neurologist. They've not come to me as a psychiatrist. So it can come as quite a shock to learn that I believe that their problem is more psychological than neurological. But also you've got to consider what that person is accepting when they accept the diagnosis. People will view them differently. You know, if you ring up your work colleagues and say, you know, I've got this problem and it's due to multiple sclerosis, you will be given a level of sympathy.
Sure.
But if you then have to contact them and say, actually, the doctors believe my problem is psychological rather than due to a disease, I think that that's immediate downgrading of the sympathy that you will receive. So people will have to face that stigma, and that's extremely difficult. So I fully understand why people fight against the diagnosis quite often.
Well, as you write, modern society likes the idea that we can think ourselves well. And in this sort of case, it's not a matter of thinking yourself out of what is a very real violent seizure. Correct?
Exactly. I think it's interesting that we're very willing to take on the idea that, you know, positive thinking will help us to recover from things, because that suggests we're strong. That says something positive about us. But I fear that when people look at it in the opposite direction, that it's seen as a personality flaw or a weakness, when it really shouldn't be. It's an illness, and it's outside of a person's control.
Suzanne O'Sullivan, help us to understand. I'm not quite sure I'm getting this. How can the brain, just, you know, from a psychological standpoint, cause something that you describe as a violent seizure, or the person who comes to you and really can't walk, literally cannot get up and take a step, but there's nothing physically wrong with this person? Do we
don't fully understand the mechanisms, but there certainly are clues. So, for example, dissociation is something that we all do regularly. It's a normal physiological thing. Dissociation is where you sort of separate from your surroundings. So, for example, you read a page of a book and you get to the bottom of a page and you don't remember anything you've read. Or you're watching the news, listening for a particular part of the broadcast, and although you're listening, you miss it. So that's our kind of mind separating away. And it's something that happens to us normally, but we believe that may be a related mechanism that leads people to actually have blackouts and convulsions. Similarly, if you think about movements, if a thought can trigger a movement, then it's entirely reasonable to say that a thought can prevent a movement. So if you believe you can't move, it's entirely likely that you have willed it so. You know, anyone who's ever stood on the edge of a diving board and tried to jump off and found that they simply couldn't have had the experience of having an emotional thought prevent them from moving.
Yeah. Is there widespread recognition and sympathy within the medical community for psychosomatic illness? And I ask this because initially these seizures were called hysterical seizures and now dissociative seizures, which probably sound a lot better to the patient.
Yeah, I mean, when they were called hysterical seizures, in fact, historically, that was not meant in the way we mean it now. So that was considered to be a brain disease, where then the word hysteria got taken over and then the disease, or the illness rather, had to be renamed. With regards to the medical community, I think we reflect the same sort of proportions as society. We have people who are unsympathetic. And we also have many doctors who are entirely sympathetic to this, but we're out of our depth with what to do about it because we don't receive the training that tell us how to manage this problem. So often I think we'd like to be more straightforward with the patients and we'd like to help, but it's not always possible.
All right. Suzanne O'Sullivan is author of Is It All in Your Head? True Stories of Imaginary Illness. We're focusing on psychosomatic illness this hour of Radio Times. And if you'd like to join us for the conversation, 888-477-9499 is the number. Stay with us. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. The patient Suzanne O'Sullivan has seen over the years suffer from seizures, paralysis, severe pain, blindness, with no medically explained cause. O'Sullivan explores these cases and psychosomatic illness in her book, Is It All in Your Head? True Stories of Imaginary Illness. And again, if you'd like to join the conversation, you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times, an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or give us a call at 888-477-9499. Before we move on to other stories, I was curious, Suzanne, the patient who you call Brenda, who we discussed just a few moments ago, who had come to the emergency room suffering seizures, you determined that they were dissociative seizures, so they were psychological in nature. Was she able to find healing?
Well, unfortunately, only about 30% of people who have these sort of seizures get better from them. And that's really important to note, because I think it's considered to be a sort of a downgraded problem compared with something like epilepsy. And certainly epilepsy is a very serious disease. But in fact, people with dissociative seizures are less likely to get better than people with epileptic seizures. So in Brenda's case, I don't believe she did get better. And that's a terrible shame, because there is a potential there if we provided better help for everybody to get better. It is a treatable condition. It's the lack of services is the reason why people do so badly.
Mm. Well, your specialty is neurology, and you would not necessarily be the person, after making the diagnosis, to treat Brenda. She would need to go on and see either a psychologist or a psychiatrist, correct?
Well, yes, partially correct, but I think that's something that has to change. These are physical disabilities, and I think at the moment we really divide the brain and the mind into two really completely separate organs and specialties, so that psychiatrists and neurologists often work in completely separate hospitals, don't mind separate departments. But really, these conditions cross the boundaries between neurology and psychiatry. So I think it's more appropriate that somebody who has a primarily physical disability should also remain under the care of their neurologist. So there should be shared care between the two. But also, I should emphasize that not everybody requires extensive psychiatric help for these conditions. They can develop in different ways. So in some people, this may be a sort of pathological response to an injury. So you injure yourself and then you pay an awful lot of attention to your body in response to the injury, and that attention leads to disability. Someone like that doesn't necessarily have a major stressor in their life, doesn't necessarily need extensive help with a psychiatrist, but might very well need extensive help with a physiotherapist. So these are very individualized in terms of treatment. And I think that we need to bring psychiatry, neurology, and the physical therapies together to treat them.
Do you find a willingness within these various branches of medicine to come together and really tackle psychosomatic illness, especially considering the evidence that can cost billions to healthcare systems?
Yeah, I think there's only very recent interest in the development of services for this amongst neurologists. So one third of people who go to the average neurology clinic have a psychosomatic disorder. And yet when I was training, or in the early years of my consultancy, you never saw it represented at neurological conferences or in neurology journals. Now that's finally changing, and we're beginning to take responsibility for it. Until that happened, patients were falling between stools. They didn't quite belong to anybody, and they therefore weren't getting the help. But now there is a real upsurge in interest, and research is beginning, publications are happening, and this is being discussed at medical conferences, which is fantastic.
So in treating psychosomatic illness, what might work? Placebos? I'd heard that there might even be procedures which mimic surgery. Is this a route that some physicians go down with their patients?
I think really there are ethical issues with actively prescribing a placebo or a procedure. So, you know, while I don't doubt that would make some people better, it really raises kind of uncomfortable issues. And I think it doesn't address the underlying problem. So I wouldn't necessarily recommend the use of a placebo, although very often what a doctor is doing with their reassurances is offering a placebo, but not necessarily the prescription of a sugar pill or a procedure. Usually the treatment is very individual. If it's a physical disability, then physiotherapy, occupational therapy. If it is something that has happened in response to a particular psychological trauma, then the person may need help of a psychiatrist. Or sometimes it's a pattern of fear and avoidance. You get sick, you get frightened to do things, and then you need something like CBT, which will help you address those fears and respond to them differently.
Let's get back to doctor-patient communication, which can be a delicate dance. And sometimes, as in the case of a patient you named Shahina, it can backfire. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, Shahina was a very young girl who suffered an injury. Somebody stood on her hand, and she was unable to use her hand for a while. But when she got back to the point where, you know, bandages, etc., had all been removed, her hand looked very deformed to her, and she developed this muscle spasm in her hand, which made it absolutely impossible for her to use it. In the course of her investigations, she was given an injection of botulinum toxin, which is something neurologists routinely use for muscle spasm where a limb has become useless. And almost instantaneously, on the injection of botulinum toxin, she made a complete recovery. Mm-hmm. Now, that's impossible, because while botulinum toxin could have made her recover, it takes time to work. So it had worked too quickly, and the only explanation was that her problem had been psychogenic or psychosomatic in the first instance. Now, I think I dealt with her badly. I think I dealt with her badly because I delivered the diagnosis to her in kind of an abrupt and straightforward way that minimized her symptoms. And I think that's something that we doctors tend to do. If everything is normal and all the tests are normal and we haven't found a disease, then our inclination is to try and make people feel better by minimizing their symptoms. And that works for some people. So if you've got a headache and you just want your doctor to say you don't have a brain tumor, then minimizing the symptoms will work for you. On the other hand, if you've got a disability of the significance that Shaheen had, then minimizing the symptoms is a terrible dismissal, and it's an awful thing to happen to you. So Shaheena very much reacted against the diagnosis.
And so just to kind of get through the story in the time that we have, the short time we have, what happened with her? And her family was also there involved as well,
yeah.
Correct?
I think both she and her family were very upset by that diagnosis because they took it as an accusation that Shaheena was in some way doing this on purpose, that it was volitional, that she could stop it if she wanted to. Of course, that was not what I had intended when I had the conversation with her. And it's very much been important for me to learn how to deliver this diagnosis because it makes a huge difference. Shaheena left the hospital and I never met with her again, but I did receive letters from subsequent doctors that she went to. And she continued to have botulinum toxin injections because she absolutely believed that her problem was entirely a disease-related and that the Botox was required to cure her. But unfortunately, while it worked for a while, if you don't address... So that was a placebo in a sense, but it hadn't addressed the root cause. So, and because the root cause hadn't been addressed, the problem developed further for her.
As the physician, what emotions are going through your mind as you work with a case? And frustration, I would imagine, has to be one of them.
Well, I think it's just disappointment, because I know that if you can have the appropriate conversation, if you see someone with these sort of seizures, and there's many journal publications to support this, and you delivered the diagnosis in a way that people can understand, and they realize that it's not a dismissal, and they understand the mechanism for their problem, then actually seizures can get better as quickly as 24 hours. So it is a pivotal moment, that discussion in helping someone to get over that barrier and move from disease to psychosomatic problem. And if that fails, then the person may be looking at long-term disability. So it's terribly, terribly disappointing when it doesn't work.
All right, let's get to the phones. Beth is in Media, Pennsylvania. Welcome to Radio Times, Beth.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm a little nervous, but I wanted to call to confirm what your guest spoke about, the shame of receiving and shock of receiving a diagnosis of a dissociative disorder. I had a very traumatic medical procedure as a 13-year-old and then later as an adult, another related medical procedure. And I do have diagnostic evidence of why I do have pain. But when I went to the pain clinic, the first part was to meet with a psychiatrist for an assessment. And after a 20-minute assessment, he told me that my pain would not get better unless I dealt with the unfortunate fact that I had what he described as a multiple personality disorder. And I became very frightened by that, and I'm shocked and embarrassed, and I sort of made the appointment, excused myself, and got to the car, called the patient advocate at the hospital to have my record amended. That was how embarrassed I was.
Let Suzanne O'Sullivan just jump in here for a moment. When you meet somebody like Beth, you know, it sounds as if she's got a long journey and a frustrating journey. And it's not, there are no quick answers here, although hopefully there are answers at the end of the road.
I mean, I think it's very important for us to realize that this is a common problem. So, you know, no person should feel alone with it because, one third of people going to their doctor today have this problem. So this is something that happens to lots of people and therefore should not be associated with any sort of shame. It is an illness and it's outside of people's control. So again, it should not be considered to be a judgment of a person's personality or the type of person that you are. It is just a medical condition, and it could happen to any of us, and none of us are should expect that we are above it in any way. And I think if we could start regarding it as an illness like any other, then people like your caller wouldn't have to suffer this awful shame, because it really is unnecessary.
Beth, do you see a clear path to healing?
Yes, I do, actually. I am willing to accept that trauma and that my mind and stress play a role in the level of pain I experience, and then disability not working, the amount of time I focus on my symptoms, which you had mentioned, you know, that sort of internal focus on what's going on. So this happened 2 years ago, and I am now willing to try to go back to this same clinic and talk to the same doctor and address this diagnosis with more questions and more open mind and kind of cooperativeness. And I was very fragile, I think, when I received that, and I wasn't ready to work with it. So now I think I am. Do have problems. Sorry.
No, don't be sorry. I just wanted to jump in and say it sounds as if you are on a path, and this is, you're probably ahead of the game as compared to many of the patients that Suzanne O'Sullivan sees, because you've got a clear-cut path ahead of you, and you've accepted the perhaps a psychosomatic piece of your illness. And at Radio Times here, we just want to wish you the best of luck and healing. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I just called to hope maybe that would help other people.
And we appreciate
that. Thank you very much for the topic, and thank you for the show.
Take care. So, Suzanne, as I kind of jumped in and hopefully observed correctly, she seems to have accepted that piece of it, and acceptance is huge.
Absolutely.
And not always easily attained when you're suffering from a psychosomatic illness.
Absolutely. I mean, I would encourage people that once you get over the sort of idea of it, because it is difficult to learn of this diagnosis, it absolutely is. But I try to think of it as an empowering diagnosis. You know, now she has a new way forward. And the fact that she's accepted trying a new way is really the hardest step has just been made. And hopefully everything from here on in will get easier. And I would encourage people, you know, who worry about this, is just to try a different avenue. So many people have tried lots of medical tests. They've had loads of scans. They've tried loads of painkillers. So why not just try a different way? If that hasn't worked in the past, then maybe this different way will.
As we become more aware of psychological illness as a true illness in our society, are we becoming less judgmental?
I'm not sure that we are even close to becoming less judgmental, I think. I think we're beginning to make inroads on certain psychological problems. So depression is a little bit more accepted now than, and a little bit more talked about. So that seems to have gained some acceptance in society. But I think when it comes to physical symptoms for psychological reasons, you know, people really are still in a place where they think this is faked, this is put on, this is within a person's control. That's what we have to get over. We've got to realize it's an illness outside of people's control, and then we can move forward.
Yeah. All right, let's get to an email from Kira, who's in Mount Airy. I think it would be helpful for much more coordination between psychiatry and neurology, because treatment errors can go in both directions. Suzanne?
Yes, I wholeheartedly agree. I think the, you know, this separation of brain and mind is really not working. You know, everybody who's got a brain disease will usually have some psychological component to that, because obviously the brain contains our personality and our emotional centers and so forth. So there's a lot of overlap between what psychiatrists and neurologists do. But I would also say that we need a lot closer links between psychiatry and all of the medical specialties, because, you know, when somebody is anxious, they get chest pain and palpitations. I'm sure cardiologists would appreciate an awful lot more support. So I think we need to bring psychiatrists back into the fold, because they seem to have been kind of pushed out into their own little buildings and areas. We need to bring the mind and body, not just the mind and brain, together.
You see a wide variety of patients, of course, in your practice. Tell us about Munchausen's disorder and how this differs from psychosomatic illness.
So Munchausen's disorder, now called a factitious disorder, is distinctly different. So when someone has a psychosomatic disorder, it's unconsciously generated. They have absolutely no idea how the symptoms are being created. In Munchausen's, people are deliberately feigning illness. And they are doing it for a very particular reason. They're doing it for a particular kind of care and attention that they need, particularly from medical facilities. Now, some people kind of see that as some sort of manipulation, but it's actually a terribly serious disorder. People really put themselves in harm's way. They fake illness by doing things like putting blood in their urine to make it look like they have a bladder problem, and then they end up having invasive investigations that put them in harm's way. But they need to do that. They've got a compulsion to do that because they need care. And in fact, it's such a serious condition that it is extremely hard to recover from it. Much more serious, in fact, than psychosomatic disorders very often.
And you also write of malingerers and the story of a pseudo-patient named Scott who presented as paralyzed, but then you saw him in the parking lot standing and putting his wheelchair into the car, and he was none too happy to see you.
Yeah.
And doing it, some of these people do it for financial gain. But do these sort of variables make it that much more difficult for you as a physician to diagnose something that's difficult to parse in the first place?
I usually find that there's quite a big difference between psychosomatic sufferers and malingerers. People with psychosomatic problems present for investigations, and when the investigations are normal, they're absolutely flabbergasted and they want further investigations because they are in a search for a disease that they are sure is there. Malingerers, who are people who are deliberately feigning illness for financial gain, which is not an illness, it's an illegal activity, they don't want the second MRI scan because they know it's going to be normal.
No.
They don't need you to validate their problem. They just, because they have insight.
All right, we're talking about psychosomatic illness this hour of Radio Time. Suzanne O'Sullivan is consultant neurologist with the National Hospital for Neurology and Neurosurgery in London. She joins us this hour from NPR Studios in New York. She's also author of Is It All in Your Head? True Stories of Imaginary Illness. And we'll talk a bit more about this subject in just a moment here on Radio Times. Keep it here. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Suzanne O'Sullivan is consultant neurologist at the National Hospital for Neurology and Neurosurgery in London and author of Is It All in Your Head? True Stories of Imaginary Illness. The focus this hour, psychosomatic illness. And again, if you'd like to join the conversation, the number is 888-477-9499. So Suzanne, is psychosomatic illness exacerbated by the internet and what's available on the internet?
I don't think it's increased the frequency of it. So this condition has been around for a very long time and was equally frequent 100 years ago. I think the difference the internet makes is what we attribute our symptoms to. So in the past, 100 years ago, if I got a particular set of symptoms, the only references I had were my people in my life and my neighbors, and they planted the kind of seed of ideas in my head as to what I could be suffering with. Whereas now we can go to the internet and just have a wider range of possibilities that we can present to our doctor. Yeah. So I think it's changed attributions, but it hasn't changed the way people suffer. It hasn't changed the frequency or the sorts of symptoms necessarily.
Because sometimes you say that sometimes patients will want to try to seemingly go to the ends of the earth to try all sorts of tests to get to the root of their illness. When and how do you draw the line on testing as a physician?
Of course, that's extremely difficult because as a doctor, I don't want to be the person who misses a disease because that comes with recriminations. But that's also the reason that many doctors avoid the psychosomatic diagnosis. So that line can be difficult. In neurology, it is a much more straightforward procedure because generally the disabilities that we see in neurology don't fit with anatomy and therefore the diagnosis is usually straightforward, and after we've done some electrical tests we can draw the line at further tests. Mm-hmm. I think with more non-specific symptoms like pain and tiredness it is much more difficult, but time will usually provide you with an answer. So you try and do an appropriate number of investigations and then continue to keep the person under your care and see how things evolve over time is often how things will clear up in most cases.
And yet, as a physician, the challenge is you cannot leave any stone unturned. And you illustrate the woman you call Fatima, her story.
Mm. Yes, I mean, you know, it was very much a case that, you know, Fatima's behavior when she presented to the hospital was what we would refer to as hysterical, perhaps in the past, you know, in the modern sense of it, you know, that it was she was emotionally overwrought. So that really I formed the impression, it is utterly impossible as a doctor when you meet someone for the first time not to form some impression. So I very much formed the impression that her problems, which were weakness down one side, were possibly psychosomatic. However, this is a diagnosis you make after consideration. So that was the first impression that I had. But when I ultimately then went ahead and did a brain scan, we found that she had a meningioma, a benign brain tumor that was causing her symptoms. So it's incredibly important in patients with psychosomatic disorders that they're given the correct consideration, they're listened to, they're examined properly and investigated appropriately, rather than it being a judgment that a doctor makes when a patient walks in the door.
And perhaps it's appropriate at this time, we should just take this email from Robert, who asks again, how do you diagnose a psychosomatic disorder? So could you briefly review that for us, Susanna Sullivan?
Certainly in the case of neurology, it is generally a straightforward diagnosis. So just to give the example of paralysis, when we examine people who have something like paralysis, as a neurologist, we're looking firstly for pattern of muscle weakness. So the pattern of muscle weakness in brain disease, muscle disease, spinal cord disease is different in each of those cases. And the psychosomatic pattern of muscle weakness does not mimic any of them. It tends to affect an array of muscles that are anatomically impossible. In addition, you will find a big difference between the objective findings. So your reflexes are not controlled by your unconscious or conscious mind. So they may be normal, whereas subjective things like weakness will be very abnormal. So you'll find a big disparity between objective and subjective things when you examine people. So it tends to be a sort of disability that is essentially anatomically impossible and then generally quite straightforward to diagnose.
All right, let's get to the phones once again. Kira is calling us from Philadelphia. Welcome to Radio Times, Kira.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I'm calling about a friend who, for the past few years, has gotten many, many colds and sinus infections, and she is a teacher, but has not developed an immunity to this like many other teachers do, and it's gotten to the point where sometimes she'll be sick for a month and antibiotics don't help. And it's starting to wear on her socially. She's afraid to make plans and always having to miss out on things. And I'm just wondering if this might be psychosomatic or if you've ever diagnosed someone as a psychosomatic condition when it was just colds and common sicknesses like that, not something more serious.
Interesting question, Kira. Thanks. So obviously you can't diagnose over the telephone, Suzanne, but, you know, does it necessarily have to be something as serious as a seizure to be
absolutely
labeled psychosomatic
not.
Illness?
No, absolutely not. I mean, obviously I wouldn't comment on an individual who I have not met, but if you can imagine a symptom, then that has been generated through a psychosomatic mechanism. So things like, you know, flu-like symptoms would not be unusual at all. So it's entirely a possibility. It's very difficult for a friend, I think, to address this with another friend because I find that, you know, when we give this sort of advice to others, whether it be a family member or a friend, that people can take it quite badly. So sure. Very often it is the case that someone has to come to this idea themselves. But what I would encourage somebody to do who is in this teacher's position would be to go to their doctor and just say, I'd like to consider this other possibility. It doesn't mean you have to cast aside the possibility that you are, in fact, having lots of flus and colds. It just means that you can consider two things at the same time and see if there's an alternative route that you can take.
Well, of course, psychosomatic illness can affect not only friends, but family members who have to live with the patient day in and day out. And what do you recommend for them when perhaps they feel as if they're at the end of the road in dealing with something that affects them so deeply?
I think it's really important for doctors to include family in this process because people who suffer in this way, they do need support. And family can often find it extremely difficult because they fear that there, you know, that there is some level of control, and if they can, you know, give the certain amount of help, that they can help make their partner or their loved one better. So it's important that at any consultation, I will always involve the family members so they understand exactly what's going on. All the family really can do is allow the person to come to terms with this themselves. So I think sometimes families suspect the diagnosis and they want to force their loved one to accept it also, and I just don't think that works. It creates a kind of a combative environment in which one person's saying it is and the next person saying it isn't. I think you just have to stand back and be supportive and realize that not everything is in your control. You're there for the person, but you can't solve it for them.
Mm. You touch on history in your book, Suzanne, and you alluded to this a little bit earlier in the show, but the effect of the mind on the body has been documented for millennia, at least to the time of Hippocrates.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, there are many writings that demonstrate that physicians, you know, ancient Greeks were aware that our bodies changed in response to emotional things. It really wasn't until the sort of 19th century when we began learning about physiology and anatomy that we could more clearly define what's a disease and what is more likely to be a psychological problem. So for years we couldn't separate the two. But for the last 100 years we have been able to do so. And there have been many people who have tried to address this problem, and yet it still managed to be neglected as we came into the end of the 20th century.
Early treatments included what? Hypnosis?
Well, early treatments are actually quite shocking because, I mean, the word hysteria refers to the womb. And it used to be believed that this was a condition that came from the womb. In the first instance, they thought the womb wandered around the body, and wherever it went, it caused symptoms. So if it went to your throat, you got a sore throat and so on.
Really? So,
yes.
So just the womb wandered around the body.
Yeah. And by the 19th century, they knew that the womb didn't wander around the body, but they still attributed a lot of these symptoms to both the womb and to the ovaries. So many women underwent hysterectomies in order to try and cure this condition.
Really?
And many bizarre things such as masturbation, sex, avoiding sex. So there was a lot of focus on the sexual organs with regard to treating and what caused this.
Was psychosomatic illness primarily thought to be an illness that affected women?
Yes.
Historically?
Historically, it's very interesting historically. So the two doctors who are most famous for writing about and talking about hysteria were Charcot, a French neurologist, and Freud. And what's most interesting is they both said that this was a problem that affected both men and women.
Okay.
However, both Charcot and Freud only wrote about their female patients, which I think is very interesting.
Yeah.
And that attitude has very much continued.
Yeah, worth noting, you see many men in your practice as well.
Absolutely.
All right, more telephone calls for Radio Times. Pat in Ben Salem, you are live with us. Hello, Pat. Do we have Pat?
Here.
Hi.
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 Hi. It's very my first time speaking on the radio.
Oh, well, welcome.
Thank you. I do listen a lot. My 3-year-old granddaughter was just recently diagnosed with selective mutism. She only speaks to her parents and her sister, and she doesn't speak to anyone else at, like, daycare or, like, even the grandparents. And I was just wondering if that's a neurological problem. They said that somehow anxiety is involved. So I don't know exactly what has to be done about it.
Mm. Well, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And Suzanne O'Sullivan, obviously, once again, you can't diagnose over the air.
Yeah.
But what do you think? You've got a concerned grandmother, you know,
yeah,
who again, is a family member who wants to try to help her granddaughter. What is the first
yeah.
step? What do you think?
I mean, I have to point out I'm not a pediatrician, and also so that's not a scenario that I would routinely deal with. You know, I think it's entirely possible that, you know, has a psychological cause. But, you know, there are also neurological things that can cause people to have language loss. So I think it's very difficult to comment on. But it's always worth considering and exploring because that doesn't do any harm to do so. It doesn't mean you have to dismiss the other possibilities. You can do two simultaneously.
So if you do something, and I'm not talking about Pat's granddaughter's case in specifically, but if you are working with a child, the first trip is the pediatrician. What else can you consider with children if you're not sure you're getting the proper diagnosis or if the problem persists? What other specialties?
Well, I think that basically I would approach this children in the same way that I would approach an adult. You know, if I had a specific symptom, the first thing I personally, with regard to my own health, want to make sure is that I'm seeing a doctor who specializes in exactly what I have. I don't want to see the MS specialist for my epilepsy, for example. Yeah. So I think you choose your doctor carefully. And you, if you don't feel that they have given you the answer, then it's perfectly reasonable to go and get a second opinion from a similar specialist. But I think at some point, if you are seeking opinion after opinion from similar specialists and they're all saying the same thing, then at some point you have to say, well, I have to run with this idea and see if that works.
All right. Comment from Guy, who says, the power of prayer and the power of healing. What is your view on this?
Well, I think that this is a condition which depends upon our expectations and our hopes and our beliefs. So, you know, if I believe I can get better, then potentially I can get better. So I think that certainly with regard to religious beliefs, or if that is something that people find comforting and helpful, that can certainly be something that could help them.
Mm. Where does hypochondria fit into this conversation, Susanna Sullivan?
Yeah, so hypochondria is related but an entirely different condition. So in a psychosomatic disorder, you are disabled by a real physical symptom and you may have no anxiety other than appropriate amount of anxiety for that symptom. So it's the physical thing that's disabling you. In hypochondria, you worry about little symptoms. So the disability is the anxiety about your health and the anxiety and how you react to small symptoms. So the symptom itself might be tiny. It could be, you know, a very small pain that doesn't disable you at all, but it's the attention you pay to the pain and the anxiety surrounding the pain that causes the problem.
Does that fall under the umbrella of the worried well?
I think the worried well is a little bit different, because the worried well, I guess this is a spectrum. The worried well is a lot of us, actually. So a lot of people who go to the doctors, and I wouldn't discourage this, you know, people with headaches go to the doctor and say, I'm worried I have a brain tumor. That's perfectly fine. That's someone who's worried well, and they're generally able to take the reassurance that's offered to them. The difference with hypochondria really is it's much more extreme. So you go to the doctor and you're reassured when you're there with the doctor, but then when you go home and think about it, you feel less reassured. So it's much more intense sort of anxiety.
So Suzanne, back to psychosomatic illness for just one more moment. You say you've come to realize these disabilities can serve a very important purpose. How so? When words aren't available, how so?
To a certain group of people, this is a body crying out for help. So I would see people who've suffered significant psychological traumas, and they're aware these traumas took place. So it's, you know, I'm not going back to Freudian times when we thought this was all repressed and hidden in your unconscious. People know they've had stresses and believe that they have dealt with them, but they haven't dealt with them as adequately as they should, and therefore their distress comes out as physical symptoms. I consider these symptoms in a certain way to be the body's, it's talking for you. It's making a cry for help on your behalf. In a certain way, these symptoms are your friend, but they're only your friend if you listen to them and respond to them correctly.
And if somebody thinks, well, perhaps this is my story, what is the first step?
I think go and have a really honest conversation with your doctor, because that will allow your doctor to consider this in a really judgmental environment.
Well, on that note, Suzanne O'Sullivan, great to have you along for Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
Suzanne O'Sullivan is consultant neurologist at the National Hospital for Neurology and Neurosurgery in London and author of Is It All in Your Head? True Stories of Imaginary Illness. Don't forget to check out our Facebook page and our podcasts. Simply head to whyy.org/Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. As always, thanks so much for joining us for Radio Times.